Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Monday, April 7th. Thousands rallied at the state capitol this weekend for a hands-off Hawaii protest, with many more protests held on the neighbor islands. We'll hear from a few of them. We talked to a local constitutional law expert about one law firm's efforts to fight the Trump administration. Trump has barred the firm's employees from entering federal buildings. Are we in a constitutional crisis? And two homegrown companies are making waves nationally in the efforts to reduce climate emissions. We Hanahoa an interview with a Big Island business trying to make Gas X for goats and cows. Why feeding them seaweed could be the answer to greenhouse gas emissions. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This week, more than 3,000 people turned out to a hands-off Hawaii protest at our state capitol on Saturday. It was just one of many demonstrations held across the state and the country in big cities and small towns to protest what many of the executive orders issued by President Donald Trump. Ugh, where do I begin, was one humorous sign from the gathering. From the massive layoffs of federal workers to what some say are heavy-handed immigration actions to the fears about privatization of institutions like the National Weather Service and Social Security Administration and the elimination of the Department of Education and other federal agencies.
Fire Elon! Fire Elon! Dump Trump!
One state worker we talked to showed up to sign wave to say, hands off our constitutional rights. Here's Evan Yazawa.
I do care about, you know, the environmental issues, the education issues, health care. Like, you know, a person in charge of the of national health care who doesn't believe in vaccines, I mean, you know, and then there's like the tariffs and like the like queer rights, foreign policy is another one. Like, we just basically shafted all our allies. Jeez, I don't know where to stop. It's like, pretty much it's been one nightmare after another. It's like, it's awful.
And anybody in your circle affected by these cuts?
Yes, yes. We have friends who've lost their jobs to the DOGE cuts. And there are many educators in our group of circles too, like people who get funding from the government for their research and things like that. We have a lot of queer friends who are stressed out. We even have some Eastern European friends as well. So there's a lot of our friend circle is affected, actually, yeah.
And Tamara, who was there with Evan and their son, works in environmental research. She told us just how widespread her concerns are as she considers her career, her family, and the community she lives in.
Hi, I'm Tamara, and I work in environmental and cultural resource management here. And I mean, we've definitely known a lot of people to be affected by the cuts. Something that, you know, a couple things besides what we've mentioned already is the just the real assault on the civil service at the federal level, like the park service, museums, science funding. It's just, I really feel like they're trying so actively to set us back by 50 years in terms of scientific research and conservation, reproductive rights. Like, we don't even really know where to start or end. I kind of just wanted to write a sign that said all of it, just all of it. But, you know, we care about our kid too. Like, what kind of future is he going to have, you know, as we slip into fascism? And, you know, cutting funding or just completely cutting the Department of Education, what kind of insanity? Is this a dark comedy that we slipped into? This can't be real, right? Yet it is.
And then what do you think about the turnout?
I'm so pleased. I'm amazed. I'm impressed.
Oh, yes.
It's really beautiful. We saw someone who was in the garb of a priest earlier that said Jesus loves immigrants, and it warms my heart to see people coming out for so many issues.
And Jennifer Graves says she's worried about the U.S. abandoning a longtime allies, and told us how the actions of the Trump administration are affecting her own family.
I love Canadians, and it's really hard to see. I think that's probably the worst part of all of this, is how this administration is treating our allies, our friends that have fought beside us in nearly every silly war that we've ever fought. That, and I really feel like women's rights are under attack. I have a daughter. I'm very scared for her. I'm feeling very Handmaid's Tale up in here. So
I saw somebody dressed as a handmaid.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like it's becoming, I heard this today earlier today, it's like it's becoming nonfiction. And that's scary. So that's, yeah, just some of the reasons why we're out here.
What does your sign say?
It says Medicaid, Social Security. That's my dad. My dad just got a lung transplant thanks to Medicaid, and he's on Social Security. I have two kids, both of them getting a public education right now. One of them special needs, who does get federal funding. My uncle is a veteran, and then there's my data.
Those were just a few of the voices at Saturday's rally at the Hawaii State Capitol. Organizers say thousands more across the state and the country gathered. They gathered in Hilo, Kahului, Lihue, and Lanai City. There are many legal challenges to the president's executive orders, from funding cuts to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs to the abrupt firings by DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, led by billionaire Elon Musk. On Friday, we talked to Avi Soifer, former dean of the University of Hawaii William S. Richardson School of Law. He just signed an amicus brief, a friend of the court filing, in a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of a law firm targeted by Trump because of the cases that they had worked on. He says more than 300 other constitutional law professors signed on in support of the argument that the firm's constitutional rights were being violated.
We are in a deep constitutional crisis. And in fact, I think it shouldn't be singular crisis. There are a whole bunch of crises. And the ways in which you can go through the screaming out constitutional problems in what they've been doing is just amazing. So I was one of, 364 constitutional law teachers who signed an amicus brief. And that was on behalf of the law firm Perkins Coie that didn't fold, unlike some of the more prestigious ones.
Yes.
And they are suing. So the law firm said they can't do this to us. And it's largely First Amendment, but it's also about the right to counsel. You know, basic things, basic First Amendment things. Viewpoint discrimination is kind of a chief no-no in First Amendment law. Well, that's exactly what they're doing. And they're doing it. What is DEI? Nobody knows what DEI is, which gives them void for vagueness problems, but they can use it like a hammer, a cleaver, any kind they want.
Just the other day, our Department of Education got that Dear Colleague letter, and you know they have 10 days to explain where they're at with the DEI programs. But everywhere you look, it's, you know, First Amendment on the campuses, the targeting of the law firms, it just goes on and on. And we see our state attorney general joining, you know, other states in challenging this. But the worry is that the process is just slow.
But the law will never catch up with all these problems. That's right. There are lasting effects of cutting off funds. Once the funds are appropriated, you can't do it. That's a central argument. Nixon tried, and it was called impoundment, and the Supreme Court said no to Nixon. You can't do that. Now, our governor can do that. There are differences in state law. But Nixon and the federal government was told very firmly, you cannot do it, and then they passed a statute. So if Congress rules, and they are the ones who are supposed to appropriate, you just cannot do that. But that's what they're doing across the board. And then you might get to some arguments that these are a little bit far-fetched, I guess, in terms of the central point. But if someone has something, you can't just take it away. They might have a property claim or a contracts claim. And famous Supreme Court statement about this, actually in the Hawaii case, is if you have more than a unilateral expectation of having something, a property right, let's say, then you get due process. They can't just do it. And if it's investment-backed expectation, then, said Rehnquist for the court, you certainly have a property claim in a case involving Kaiser. So there are all these private claims, public claims, and, you know, counsel, the notion that these law firms are folding because they think they need the money, which I think is a little bit exaggerated, to put it mildly. You know, even FDR learned that you can't just say, oh, I want to fire you. FDR, of course, had one of the great popular mandates, unlike a current claim about the greatest mandate in history. And yet the Supreme Court said no. That's a case that's been narrowed by our current court, and unfortunately, including Chief Justice Roberts in some of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency cases. But the notion that there is a unitary executive is so counter to the text of the Constitution, to the originalism argument, to the things that conservatives usually like. The framers of the Constitution, neither in the initial framing or the post-Civil War constitutional amendments, did not want a king. They didn't want a president like Andrew Johnson, who was exactly the problem. So the notion that a president has all this power, there's nothing in the text, nothing that supports that. And unfortunately, that's what Chief Justice Roberts went with in the presidential immunity decision at the end of the term last time. And I should say, Roberts manipulated timing, which he's done before, and sometimes it's accepted that judges can do that somewhat. But he, in the case of Trump, at the beginning of the term, near the beginning of the term, there was the Colorado ballot question. And they had fact-finding, and they said insurrection, and they said, look, the Constitution, 14th Amendment, Section 3 talks about that, so he can't be on the ballot. And then the court came up with a cockamamie theory that no, Congress has to act first. Well, what about that in these contexts, like appropriations? But that was okay. They kept him on the ballot. At the end of the term, and it was, one could think, purposely at the end of the term, oh, look at all this presidential immunity for anything that he did that's presidential, and maybe even some things that aren't in the usual context. And it's an astonishing decision, which has no support. And, you know, Nixon could not withhold the tapes. And Truman couldn't seize the steel mills, even though the Korean conflict was going on. But now we're saying, oh, the president, sure, the president can do it. It's stunning. It really is. And I think it's worse than McCarthyism. This is just, you know, getting letters. This is only the latest that kind of jumped out to me. So they write to people and they say, by the way, you cannot say race is a social construct. You just can't do that anymore. It's not, says the administration. Well, there's a Supreme Court decision 30 years ago or more. Unanimously, the court says, most biologists and most anthropologists tell us that race is a social construct. They say, well, not everyone says it. And so they accept that. The U.S. Supreme Court does that. And here's a new administration saying, nobody's allowed to say that. That was when they were going after the Smithsonian and after the new African-American museum on the Mall.
Well, there is concern about, you know, how fast things are moving. And, you know, people are saying, well, Congress appropriates the money. And why don't we see this being raised? You know, why is this allowed to happen? You know, why is it that USAID is, you know, deconstructed if Congress holds the purse strings? You know, this morning I just got word that, you know, the there is someone there in the office, the Peace Corps office, and they've got the DOGE folks in place now. So they're a little leery because, you know, from what I understand, the continuing resolution funds that office, but they just fear that that office is going to go the way of USAID and everything else.
Yeah, and because we no longer believe in soft power at all. It's only survival of the fittest. I mean, it is. He's right in the sense of going back to the time of McKinley, not that that was a wonderful time in terms of race relationships, for example, but social Darwinism was the order of the day, and the meek would not inherit the Constitution.
You know, we have also seen the Trump administration throw out the labor contracts, which was stunning. I mean, we first saw the TSA one, but then just to say that everything else doesn't count, and we're still waiting, you know, for something to happen on that front. But, you know, you talk about where's the rule of law, you know, where's contract law? It's a mess.
They use phrases as if they are self-defining. Diversity, equity, and inclusion being one. And there are words in there that are not so bad. Equity, for example, is about fairness. They, by the way, have said fairness is one of the things you can use, but you can't use equity. But waste, fraud, and abuse, we just toss that phrase around. And that's a way of going after whatever budget they want to go after without ever showing the evidence that there was waste, fraud, and abuse.
And let's get back to that conversation that I had with former University of Hawaii Law School Dean V. Soifer. He's a constitutional law expert and was one of 364 professors who signed an amicus brief, a Friends of the Court filing, on behalf of a law firm that President Trump has targeted.
I think last time we talked, I said there is some shard of optimism in terms of what state courts are doing. And I was very proud of our Supreme Court, which issued a statement in about mid-March that said, we strive to ensure that all people receive fair and respectful consideration in our courtrooms. We are guided in this work by the Aloha Spirit Law. And they said, in alignment with that vision, the judiciary remains resolute in our commitment to increasing access for all. They talked about the law of the splintered paddle, and they talked about how it seeks to elevate all people by recognizing their common humanity and eliminating the barriers that keep them from fully participating in society. Now, that's an unusual thing for a Supreme Court to do. Each justice signed it, and they were clearly doing it in response to what's going on all around us and going on in the federal courts and in the federal law and the separation of powers as we used to know it. that deserves more publicity than it's gotten, their particular statement, which was March 12th.
Well, so how much weight does that carry?
In the federal courts, really none. But it does suggest that we in Hawaii are lucky and that we could go into state court in some ways. Now, once in a while, a state court can do something that really does affect the federal government, but basically they can't. They can say, as they did and got away with it, that our view of arms, our view of guns, our view is different here because the Supreme Court had said you use history. And they said, okay, we'll look at our history. And look, our history says back to the time of the monarchy that something that was potentially death-causing, like slung shots they talked about, could be banned, could be regulated, could be banned. So they got away with it because it was a complicated procedural matter, and the Supreme Court denied cert, meaning the Supreme Court did not take that case for review, with a few of the more conservative justices dissenting from the denial of cert. But it was a direct kind of, no, we're not going to go your way. And I thought, very well written and cleverly done. So that may mean that someone who wants a Second Amendment claim will go into federal court and not state court. And there are all sorts of complicated questions about when you can remove a case, removal from state court to federal court. But it's a little bit of optimism in this terrible legal time.
Well, what would you like to underscore at this point as we watch, you know, every day, you know, these institutions being dismantled? And no one is stepping up, or at least the process under which we would normally work out these things with the separation of powers, you know, the damage is being done.
Well, a couple of things. So I'm particularly concerned about lawyers and the ways in which lawyers are being punished, because I've taught law for a very long time and hung out with lawyers. Lawyers are not always right, but lawyers do have some important, if not noble, things to do when they represent people, even when the people may be dissenters in the minority, not popular. And the classic historical example of this is John Adams. After the Boston Massacre in 1770, the British soldiers who shot the folks who were gathering were put on trial for murder. John Adams was already an up-and-coming politician and a very good lawyer. And at the expense of some of his clients, he took the case first of the guy who was in charge, Captain Preston, and then of the eight soldiers who were implicated. And he said, this is my duty as a lawyer. And a quote that I really like from Adams is, facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. So I have hope that this is a little historical moment, and then we will go back to understanding the importance of dissent, the importance of not just firing people because you want to. It's a cruel thing to do, and they're doing it very ineffectively and inefficiently, except that it's effective in ruining people's lives. And that will not be made up. That's what I mean with you can't go back. But there will be litigation, let us hope, and federal judges are standing up for the most part and doing their duty and following the text. The text is a starting place. The text of the Constitution, the text of the laws. It's not the end. I like to quote that the text has a vote, but it doesn't have a veto. So you do other things. You're not bound by the text, and the text is often turned upside down by the court, by the Supreme Court. So we can't just say, oh, the text is the answer. And we know the text means different things to different people and so on. The facts matter, and that's John Adams' quote. So the facts are there to be found with care, with process. Due process is kind of key. But also, there is a notion in this country, Statue of Liberty, many other symbols of the notion that we are for diversity. And we celebrate not the melting pot, but the crisp salad, where every ingredient keeps its own flavor but adds to the whole. And Hawaii, I think, really stands for that more than anywhere else. So I want to say, again, we're lucky, and in some ways, we're lucky to be somewhat isolated, but we're not really isolated. It is a terrible time.
You're a constitutional law expert, and you are watching this play out in very painful ways. How do you deal with this?
Well, it is a challenge for teaching, because you don't want people to be cynical, and it is enough to make people cynical, and cynicism is not the answer. So it really is to stand up, as a New Jersey senator just did for 25 hours. And he talked substance when he stood up. So that, I think, we have to do with demonstrations, with letters, with signing briefs, so with anything we have, and with making contributions to good causes. And I think it's pretty easy to tell which nonprofits, for example, are on the right side of these matters. So I think, you know, as he did, as Senator said, you know, people are going to ask, let's say, our children and our grandchildren, where were you when what I hope will be regarded as the McCarthy era is as a terrible era? What did you do? And I think you're right to ask, and there are many ways to do things about this, including asking fair-minded judges to use their fair minds and what the precedents really say in constitutional law and elsewhere to come out on the side of fairness, equity, inclusion, and diversity, if I dare say those words.
That was Avi Soifer, former UH Law School dean and constitutional expert, who signed an amicus brief in a lawsuit against the president who has targeted law firms who previously worked on cases against him. Soifer says in a rare move, the Association of Law Schools has taken a position on some of the issues challenging Trump's recent orders.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Yes, you are tuned to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Time Magazine and Statista have named two Hawaii businesses based at the Ocean Science and Technology Park in Kailua Kona to a list of the top 250 companies reducing environmental impact. The Natural Energy Lab of Hawaii Authority, or NELHA, leases space to Blue Ocean Barns and Terraformation. This week, we're reaching into our archives to bring you interviews with these award-winning green tech startups. The mission behind Blue Ocean Barns is commercializing Hawaii seaweed, and its future looks promising. Not so much for human consumption, but for cattle. It's to feed to cows in order to cut the methane that cows burp. Sounds wacky, but early research shows it does work. We highlighted Blue Ocean Barns back in 2023. We toured the facility at NELHA with the company's co-founder and CEO, Joan Salwin. The seaweed is sustainably harvested and then propagated in huge tanks where they tumble and grow.
It's bubbling around just as it would in tide pools or in, you know, the shallow areas out in the ocean. So it's experiencing the sunlight it loves, the seawater that has been pumped from the ocean, so it loves that too. So it's just, you know, thriving and growing and propagating. And as it does, we harvest it and allow room for more to come behind it and grow.
We talked to Salwin about the promise of an industry where demand is not likely to be a problem.
It's an affirmation that what we're doing will have a market, will have a need, and will be really a way for Hawaii to be participating in the new economy, the new low-emission economy. So what we're doing here is taking tiny samples sustainably from the ocean of a limu and growing it out and just really providing it with growth conditions it just naturally loves. And so it does its thing. If we provide it with the sunshine and the seawater, the nutrients, the motion of the water, it does its thing. And when it does, it propagates and grows and splits and sloughs off new growth that then spawns even more growth. We can get it to a scale at which it can be harvested and dried, milled, and fed to cattle. And when it is fed to cattle, as part of their diet, a very small part of their diet, it almost completely shuts down their emission of methane gas, which is an enormously potent contributor to climate change. And prior to really finding this Hawaii-based limu as kind of a gas X for cows, a beano for cows, there really wasn't any good solution at all for shutting down methane gas production in cattle, which is just a natural process of their digestion. So we're working closely with a couple of very, very large food companies that use a lot of dairy products and a lot of meat products in what they put on shelves for consumers. They're really concerned about their responsibility to deliver those products in a really sustainable and responsible way. And so they're partnering directly with us and investing in us so that we can scale this up and make this LEMU available to cows all around the world.
And so who are your contracts with now? I mean, where is this in use?
Yeah, so several of our customers have made announcements about their use of this. One is Ben & Jerry's ice cream. Another is Strauss Family Creamery, which is a small California dairy. Clover Sonoma Dairy, which is kind of all over the West. So several people are using this and are announcing it. Others are kind of in a wait and see where they're using it, but they're not yet ready to lend their name to the solution until they are comfortable that it's a good fit within their operation.
As the seaweed gets harvested and processed, I mean, you develop it into different forms so that you can, you know, add this to the cattle feed?
The primary form is as a powder. So it's minimally processed and used as a whole plant. You know, it's not extracted. We just dry the whole plant and crush it up, and it becomes a powder, which just gets added into feed like a lot of other powders. Cattle operations are adding amino acids or minerals, whatever, in that form, and ours is just one more ingredient.
So how do the cows like it?
Cows like our seaweed, which is grown in tanks. Some of the ocean-grown seaweed that has been fed in university trials is a little high in iodine, and it is a little metally, and so cows have shown that they will only eat so much of that. But in the two trials that have used our material grown here in Hawaii, the cows have gobbled it up.
And that was part one of our conversation with Joan Salwin, CEO of Blue Ocean Barms, who was talking about the company's approach to commercializing Limu Kohu to help cut the methane gas generated by the cattle industry. During the pandemic, while many industries were forced to cut workers, many of the business at the Natural Energy Lab kept people employed. We'll return to this interview right after a short break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
And it continues on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Let's return to our conversation from 2023 with the co-founder and CEO of Blue Ocean Barns, Joan Salwin. Her startup was recently recognized by Time Magazine and Statista as one of the companies, or one of the country's top companies, disrupting or reducing climate change. Gosh, as far as this plan then to scale up, you're hoping then to convince other businesses that this is the green thing to do, right? I mean, the responsible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. The most likely customers for our product don't need to be convinced, because what we're finding is that there's a large number of companies, Catherine, that have made really bold announcements about what they're going to achieve in terms of emissions reductions by 2025 or by 2030. And companies who have announced really bold targets like 30% reductions or 50 or net zero, if they have cattle in their supply chain, they just can't get anywhere near those reductions unless they're really addressing the problem of methane gas that is produced during digestion. And this is by far the best way to do that. So we actually do not consider demand a problem. Supply is what we're all about, and scale, because a number of corporations are looking at their prospects for hitting their targets and see no way unless we partner with them. So we do have plans right here in Hawaii to scale up and to operate a large plant here. In addition, we know that we need to be near to farms that are using the material so that we don't, you know, do a great job for the environment by reducing methane, but then also pollute the environment through all of our transportation. So we're at the same time growing in Baja California and in San Diego, which is cutting the transportation a great deal. We will probably ultimately have these kinds of farms coastal throughout the world, you know, in North Africa or in Chile, those kinds of places, so that we can serve very large cattle markets that are near those farms.
Are there any other international companies that have been eyeing your product, or, you know, where this is in use?
Right now, all of our customers are based in the United States. There's a lot of demand in the United States. There are 100 million cattle that need to be fed here. So we got our hands full. Some of our customers are global, and they see doing the United States as the first step towards their corporate responsibility and then moving to South America and Europe and their other markets.
What about locally?
Locally is so exciting. I'm glad you asked. We're currently gearing up to, starting in January, feeding our product to the Hawaii Island Goat Dairy. They will be our first local customer, and they're tremendously excited about what we can do to reduce the gas from their goats, which are also ruminants. They have the same digestive system as cattle and sheep, bison, etc. And those goats are emitting methane gas, and Hawaii Island Goat Dairy is committed to driving that way down.
Hooray, because I have noticed an explosion of goats on this island, and I was really kind of shocked to see the numbers and was hoping that somehow we were putting them to good use, either as a food product or, you know, that somebody was using them, you know, because we talk about sustainability here, and that's all part of the picture.
Exactly. And I think there's a use both for goat milk and cheese, et cetera. And also, goats are known to eat grass and other weeds and whatever, and maintain, you know, a low level of forage in areas where it otherwise might get out of control. A number of industry groups are watching us closely and are supportive. The American Feed Industry Association is really interested in our role as a feed additive and supplement. The dairy industry is all in. U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef is all in. All of us here live here. We're all here to stay. And we're really proud of what this state is positioned to do for the environment. The methane gas from cattle particularly is one of the big unsolved problems of the environment. You know, we think we know what we need to do with renewable energy and with vehicles, et cetera. But the cow is a big problem. With 1.5 billion cows in the world, they emit as much gas as all cars. And so to have a solution coming out of this wonderful state that can be exported and propagated and spread through the world really puts Hawaii in a great position to be a leader in sustainability in a way that before this was unsolved. What we're growing here is just like alfalfa or corn or hay or grasses that cows eat. We're growing a photosynthesizing organism. We're drying it and mixing it in their feed. It couldn't actually be more natural. It's perfectly suited to the job that we're putting it to. Of course, I do hear lots of jokes. I hear a number of mothers say, if I fed this to my 13-year-old son, would it maybe help out? And unfortunately, since her son only has one stomach, he's not a ruminant. He doesn't have a rumen, so he's not really able to process this seaweed, but neither is he emitting methane that we need to worry about. I think people are looking for a Beano for cows or a Gas X for cows, and here it is. I do know a lot of people ask me, are you sure it's burps and not the other end? Mm-hmm. And I can assure them that it is burps. And the reason for that is, as I mentioned, this all of the fermentation of grass and the creation of methane is in the first of the four stomachs. So the gas doesn't have a chance to get through the other four stomachs and then through the small intestine, large intestine. 95% of the gas that is emitted by a ruminant, a goat or a cow, comes right out the mouth.
Okay, it's belching.
It's belching.
Yes, Gas X or Beano. That was Joan Solomon of Blue Ocean Barns. And since our interview 2 years ago, the company has moved a large part of their production operation to San Diego to be closer to the cattle industry. But Solomon says it does maintain key offices at the NEHA facility in Kailua-Kona. And that's it for us today. I'm Catherine Cruz.